coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well. Hope everybody is doing great. I am getting ready for a couple weeks on the road. The next couple Tuesdays will be fully pre-recorded episodes. But as always, we are bringing you nothing but new content. I just confirmed we will be having our friend Greg Lawson on the show next week. And we have tons and tons of awesome content coming up for you. Angela Thompson Smith is coming up for you. We've also got Jason Quick coming up in that same episode. Both of them talking about Jason talking about astral projection and shamanic journeys. Angela talking about shamanic healing, shamanic journeys. So that's going to be a great episode. We've got Reverend Michael J.S. Carter in the second part tonight, talking about Reiki energies and sources of Reiki energies and where these things might source from, and how his experiences actually changed his perception of these things. So we'll be getting into that tonight. In the first part, we will be welcoming our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We always talk with him about all kinds of high technology stuff, especially in the world of aerospace, things like that. For your following purposes tonight, we do have the latest document from the U.S. military, direct from the Department of Defense. Stop on by CuriousRealm.com, go to the Knowledge Vault, and then press the declassified documents, declassified program and documents. And right there is the hypersonic weapons report that literally just hit the floor of Congress yesterday. This was released on Cinco de Mayo. And some of it is pretty revelatory. Mike Turber, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey, bud. How you doing?
Doing great, man. How you been living?
I've been hanging in there, doing okay. Still out here in Florida. Can't seem to make my way back to the West Coast. That's okay. I grew up here, so I'm digging it.
Well, this was fascinating to me to go through and read this today, because some of the programs that they talk about, I mean, quite a few of the programs that they talk about, we've posted in our Curious Realm group on Facebook before. Mm-hmm. We've talked about things like the SR-72 on the show previously. But there was a huge boon yesterday that happened with Dark Eagle, the U.S., and that is the Army's program, Dark Eagle, actively hit its first major milestone with 1,725-mile strike capability. This was confirmed yesterday. This was really one of the first, I would say, absolutely successful. It's interesting going through this document because many of the programs have kind of petered out. As far as hypersonic goes,
there's a good reason for that too. Several of the programs that were out there obviously became just too expensive for the benefits that were going to come from the programs. A couple of those programs were Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and of course Lockheed. And those programs that went bye-bye, so to speak, did take advantage of all of the technology that was learned from that. Because the adversaries we're facing, the real reason why we're shifting our gears a little bit is because, according to most media outlets, they'll probably tell you that China and Russia is ahead of us when it comes to hypersonics. Whether or not that's true remains to be seen, and what you know, how you prioritize what's what on the list of what we have. But at the same time, we go through a much longer, extensive program of bringing our vehicles and weapon systems into the arena. So in doing that, that makes our programs take a lot longer to get out. But that doesn't mean we don't have things in the pipeline. There's quite a few things in the pipeline. Some are hypersonic glide vehicles. Yep. Some are actual powered vehicles. So it's going to be very interesting next 10 years.
And you know, they're talking about like air breathing engines, things like that. Basically, and what that means is something that is most hypersonic weapons right now are being launched via rocket. They have a ballistic flight path to begin with, and then they separate from that and move forward right. as basically like a second stage to a rocket. But with the air breathing capability at that point, you're talking about something that's able to be launched from the wing of an aircraft, able to be dropped and continued in flight from a B-1B, you know, something like that. That's a totally different deliverable package.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the hypersonics are nothing really new. They're just new the way we're using them.
Yeah.
Basically, ballistic missile, ICBM, which launches MIRV, you know, a multiple entry, re-entry vehicles. Those are essentially hypersonic, weapon systems as well. But they're not in the course of what I would determine what we want to focus on today as far as that subject is concerned is an object that's quickly, put on the field, quickly accessible, and also can, be directed towards its target, as opposed to having a ballistic curve and you just hope it goes right and you can't, you know, stop it afterwards. Yeah. So those capabilities are what's advancing more than anything. And the most advancing, that's going on right now is in the air breathing, vehicles such as the SDAR-72, Project Mayhem, Dark Eagle, and some of the other programs, which are achieving pretty good results. Yeah. There's two types of systems. You have hypersonic glide and hypersonic cruise missiles, which are your true weapon systems. Then you have other, vehicles that use, also use scramjets and things of that nature, which would include a possible manned aircraft, which we all saw in Tom Cruise fly around.
So
those are a distinct possibility. We don't have a manned hypersonic vehicle at this moment. But is that in the works? Yeah, who knows?
Well,
I know that Elon Musk is chomping at the bit.
And, you know, here is a hugely important part of this right here. Hypersonic weapons could challenge detection and defense due to their speed, maneuverability, and low altitude of flight. For example, terrestrial-based radar cannot detect hypersonic weapons until late in the weapon's flight. The figure below depicts this. And when you look at that, like, that is a massive difference, man. When you're talking about an intercept path of about a third of the way up, if you imagine an ICBM, I'm tracing it out, the green arrow there. You can see where that direct line of sight from the radar gives you a good amount of warning, you know, gives you a third. You go to hypersonic where it's like basically launched partially with a rocket. And then from there, it takes over in a much lower trajectory and flight path.
Yeah, the reason for that, the rocket has to get the vehicle up to speed for engines to actually function.
Yeah.
They have to ram a lot of air in those pulse scramjets and all that. And I was going to make one tonight just so you, I could demo one real quick, and I'll probably do that on the next show if you like.
But
when you
go through and look at this, I mean, right here, U.S. defense officials have stated that both terrestrial and current space-based sensor architectures are insufficient to detect and track hypersonic weapons. Noting that the hypersonic targets are 10 to 20 times dimmer than what the U.S. normally tracks by satellites in geostationary orbit.
Especially when you're talking about the glide vehicles, because you're not talking about a powered vehicle at that point. Now the scramjets are easily seen. And we use phased array radar, around the country and it can pick up on these objects, at any speed that they're traveling. It doesn't matter what speed they're going at. It'll still pick them up. But the problem is that they will have already penetrated so deep into our sensor net that by the time we can respond to them, that's where the issue comes in. It has nothing to do with us necessarily being able to tell if they're there or not. It has to do with us being able to respond to it. And what are we going to use? You know, we've got our own version of the Iron Dome. Does it function, against these hypersonic threats? We don't know yet. I haven't seen very positive results in that regard. I've seen fairly decent results, but our laser-based systems are actually coming along quite nicely as well, as far as defense is concerned.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, once again, it is kind of troubling whenever you look at that flight path and see that time of detection where it's like, no, it's basically on you. By that point, like, and the interesting part is once again, that nuance of flight that you get with a hypersonic vehicle, even though, once again, you know, a ballistic missile can reach a hugely long range, stuff like that. You are talking about something that once it's lobbed, it is not changing trajectory.
Yeah.
You know, and, you can't really steer a ballistic missile in that kind of way.
Yeah, you're gonna, it's like shooting a cannon. You're gonna aim it the best you can and hope like hell it works. That graphics is slightly misleading though.
A little bit.
Keep in mind this document is being given to Congress. And it's basically saying, hi, we have a problem. We need more money. And here's the problem, but they don't really give you the full picture here. Keep in mind that most of the missile systems, when they launch, they're not detected by some long range radar somewhere. That's not how they detect it. They're detected by infrared scanning satellites that are in the sky that basically can detect a missile within a second or two of its launch anywhere on the planet.
Yeah.
So we can track those objects instantaneously. We've all seen NORAD, Crystal Palace and all that stuff. And so we kind of have an idea of how that kind of works, even though, you know, currently those systems are in multiple locations rather than just in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So, but I'm actually reading this for the first time on a couple of these things.
Yeah. Going through and reading this today, it was fascinating to go through and because once again, it threw my mind immediately back, to just before the New Jersey drone flap.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, well, why aren't we having a larger conversation about this? And you hear a former admiral and you hear a former NASA scientist and you hear a Lou Elizondo and they're all like, well, if we have a larger conversation, the only conversation that could be had is the fact that we have a gaping hole in our sensor platforms and our detection platforms. And that's basically what they're saying with the same effect here. And what's really funny is when you go further in the document, it starts talking about China. It starts talking about Russia. But a lot of what it talks about with China and Russia is how they are utterly afraid that the U.S. is like tip of the spear on this. And like, and it's like, well, I don't know. I'm sorry if I'm giving away national secrets. Somebody may kick in my window in a second from a helicopter. I don't know. But it's one of those, like, I don't think we're that far ahead, China and Russia.
On some things we're actually behind. Some of the missile type systems, Russia would be ahead. Keep in mind, Russia used one of their missiles, their hypersonic missiles in Ukraine.
Yeah.
It used it as more of a kinetic energy weapon, which is
okay. But it's one of those like you at that speed, you do not need anything more than the weight of the actual projectile. You don't need 10 tons of TNT or you know some exotic explosive.
Right. Exactly. And so kinetic energy packs one hell of a punch. And the good thing about it is you don't have to put a whole bunch of avionics into it. You don't have to put a bunch of you know, there's a whole lot of things you don't have to do. And they're easy to deal with. Just like when we were building the rail guns, which we pretty much have put that system aside because something way better is coming out besides the rail system. And I think we touched on that before. But you know, you've got an object that is being propelled above Mach 6, and it has enough energy, which I don't know the math equation to come up with it right now, but the math equation would basically tell you, and it's just like a car vehicle heading towards each other, a vehicle.
Yeah.
Keep in mind an object that weighs about 3,000 pounds, which is what half of these, weigh, traveling that fast is going to make one hell of an impact.
That's right. So,
and it doesn't make noise. You know, you're not going to hear it first because it's way faster than the speed of sound.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of advantages to that, but. Back to that graphic again, the way our system works is, as far as identifying these things at launch, is right at the moment that it launches, we identify the location, the most likely object that it would be, and then we immediately start plotting the trajectory. And the problem with plotting trajectory in some of these objects is that at some point in that curve, that warhead, if you want to call it that, or the actual hypersonic missile part, is going to separate from its booster
vehicle. Right.
And when it does that, then you have a lot of questions being asked. Is this object a maneuverable one, or is this just going to be an arc where we plot the trajectory and see where it's going to go? And that's where we're at right now. I mean, we know what Russia has. We know what China has. They know what we have for the most part. But what we haven't brought into bear is our ability to defend against these systems. And that's where it's going to get tricky. That's where it's going to get really tricky because these things are fast.
Well, when they go into the Iron Dome, they go into those kind of things. One of the things that they brought up was, of course, Russia's capabilities. And I'm trying to get down to that part right now where it just says Russia. There we go.
Well, the Kazal is one of their systems, and that's the one they use in Ukraine, so it probably mentions that.
Yes, it does. It does. But the one that I am specific, here we go. There we go.
Oh, that looks familiar.
Yeah, exactly. this is the Stiletto that's launched off the Sarmat ICBM, but this one, successfully tested twice in 2016 and 2018, reportedly reaching speeds of Mach 20. Mach 20.
That's almost orbital velocity.
That is insanity. That's insanity.
Orbital velocity is Mach 25. So when the space shuttle was coming back, it was coming back at Mach 25. So this is only 5 Mach numbers below that. So it's pretty darn close to orbital velocity.
And that is incredible to think about. And once again, it did bring up what you brought up, which was always the argument in the old Cold War days whenever it came to like, well, they have this many, we have this many. Well, theirs are more powerful, where ours are more accurate. And it did
made out of metal, theirs are made out of wood.
It did absolutely mention that in here, the fact that, here it is right here. Programs. Unlike programs in China and Russia, U.S. hypersonic weapons are to be conventionally armed. As a result, the U.S. hypersonic weapons will likely require greater accuracy and will be more technically challenging to develop than nuclear-armed Russian and Chinese systems.
Yeah. So, and the way those systems work, a nuclear system, with a conventional system, you are aiming at the target and you have to basically hit that target, try to not have collateral damage or whatever it is that, that whatever the parameters are for that target. The other end of the spectrum is with the nuclear weapon. It's just get close.
Yeah.
It's not going to hit the ground. So it's going to blow up at 1500, 2000 feet, somewhere in that range, which depending on the kiloton yield. And to give the maximum amount of damage possible. And they're not indiscriminate, or they're not discriminate, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's whatever's in that area, it's gone. And we don't do that. However, keep in mind, each of our systems are nuclear capable. We always keep that back door kind of open a little bit. That doesn't mean we can slip something in really quick, but we're following the rules the best we can. Hope the rest of the world does, which
and that's just it. It even says right there, United States is conducting research, development, test, and evaluation on a number of offensive hypersonic weapons and hypersonic technologies. And yeah, when it comes to defense, we're looking at all kinds of things from an Iron Dome type system to other defenses, other hypersonic right. intercept technologies, yeah. even lasers, stuff like that. But that, yeah. that's
and we,
just
we
it.
Don't have enough missiles in our version of the Iron Dome to truly protect against all the possible threats that could come, especially, you know, keep in mind, we've been nervous about this for years, and it seemed like it was coming to fruition last year that Russia and China would join forces. So
yeah,
that's a possibility. I could even in a far stretch probably pull North Korea into that mix, but probably not.
But
we could see China and Russia if they saw a combined effort would yield both countries the results that they want, then I could see that happening. I don't want to see a World War III. I hope we can all steer clear of it. But if we do, there's a lot of interesting technologies that are going to come out that are not known yet to the public.
Well, and you know, once again, that right here, it's the U.S. Army program, and that's where they're talking about Dark Eagle, which is the one mm-hmm. that just had the successful launch. It goes into that. And the idea of to suppress adversary long-range fires and engage other high-payoff, time-sensitive targets. And that's just it. They're talking about basically, once again, kinetic weaponry, the idea of something, because that kinetic concussion isn't going to be as crazy. It, even though it might penetrate deeper, it's not going to cause as much mass destruction.
Well, the advantage of that too is it's very tactical on the object that you're trying. If you're trying to take out a specific target, a very specific target, whether it be a person or a vehicle or a building or whatever, you know, it's important that if you have a kinetic weapon type system, that that you use that to that reduces collateral damage.
Yeah,
you're not, you know, they're not going to see it coming, so to speak. It's going to look more humane than anything else that we could have used. You're not going to have all this other propaganda that would go along with it on both sides, pushing whatever agenda they're trying to push. But overall, I think the next 10 years is going to see a mix. The fastest growing technologies is drone technology, hypersonic technology, and then your space weapons and space defense type systems. Even though technically we're not supposed to do that, I don't see how we can't do that. That's why we have Space Force.
Well, that is a huge point there. That is why we have our Space Force. And in addition, to see that Dark Eagle demonstrated a Mach 5 capability. So pretty impressive. Nowhere near Mach 20, you know. And it goes in.
But any of those reentry vehicles, just so you know, anything that has a parabolic curve that goes over over the horizon, you're probably going to be approaching that because you're at suborbital speed at that point. And anything below 25 is essentially suborbital. So 10 to 20 in that range is where you're going to be.
Yeah.
On almost all ICBMs, by the way.
Yeah. And once again, the idea of detection. Brought to mind all of the issues going on with the drone flap and UFO UAP detection, things that we've talked about before, where you may not be able to detect something like without the fact of detecting things in other bands of radiation, other bands of RF, that kind of stuff. You may not be able to visually detect an object like that moving fast.
The platform that distributes the weapon is also something to look at. Obviously, submarines are our primary force. The United States has, I think, 69 or 70 submarines. Every single one of our submarines is nuclear powered. We don't have diesel submarines. We don't have battery submarines. We have all our nuclear powered. Same thing with aircraft carriers. No other country has that. And these type systems can get very close to the target, which reduces that graphic that you saw there tremendously. It also reduces it for our adversary, but China doesn't have much of a underwater program. We'll just leave it like that, especially when compared to ours. Russia was the admiration of the world when it came to submarines. They were definitely leading the pack. But they really don't have that anymore. If you look at Murmansk and some of these other areas, like where the Kursk went down and stuff like this, their boats are not like they used to be. And Russia's not like it used to be, but they still have some jewels in the mix there, where they have quite a few weapon systems that are definitely to be feared.
Well, and especially when you're talking about once again the fact that they are already and actively using hypersonic tech in the battlefield.
Absolutely,
they are not behind the curve in that kind of way. They are well ahead of it.
Systems are operational, I guess, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And not that I'm sure we don't have something in the coffers that might be able to be used in such a way, but it seems like a lot of it is really still in the waiting. And here is the part about hypersonic missile defenses, talking about hypervelocity projectiles, interceptor mm-hmm. missiles, missile defense options, laser guns. I like the way that they just say laser guns, lasers, like pew pew, and electronic attack systems. Which of course the electronic attack systems, especially on something with electronic guidance, anything like that.
Yeah. Well, if you know, we have been testing these for a long time. Keep in mind, on November 14th of 2004, we had the Tic Tac event. And the very next day, there is a correlation here, and we'll get to that in a future episode. And the very next day, they launched the X-43 with the third launch of the X-43 as a test bed for a hypersonic system. So this is way back in 2004. The first object, man-made object, put into space is effectively a hypersonic object. It was a manhole cover, and that's that was the first object to go into space from the Earth. But yeah, there you go. X-43.
Yeah, precisely. And of course, you know, we know that, I mean, we've had the conversation regularly, about the secret space plane and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. X-37B, the fact that thing was over our head for a year and a half, 2 years before it successfully returned from its first clandestine mission.
There's two of them now, by the way.
Oh yeah.
And you and I have to say this, that is one thing that Boeing got right. They did that one pretty good.
Absolutely. It is a sexy machine.
It has had no issues whatsoever. It even has, if you look at the back of it, I got to see it at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And when I was there, didn't get to touch it, but did get to see it and walk around it. And I looked at the back, and when I saw this hexagonal shaped thing, and then, you know, I'm like, well, that's kind of off centered. The whole back of it just looks like, you know, because symmetry in rocket motors and propulsion, it has to be symmetry, although you're going to skew one or another. And of course, looking at that, I go, oh, okay, they're that's different. So I didn't want to say what it was, but at the time, I found out it was an ion engine.
Wow.
Yep. That's what it was.
Yeah, and I mean, just the idea of here it is right here. This is after, and this is it landing after 434 days in space. And this is an unmanned vehicle, y'all. The X-37B is automated. It does its own thing, at least as far as we know. That doesn't mean that it doesn't carry people. Doesn't mean that people can't be the cargo.
Unfortunately for that variant right there, no, there's no life support systems on board. But keep in mind, a couple months ago, we got an image, a long away image of the Earth from that.
Yeah.
And that image is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, once again, this is a, very,
that's
very,
the first time I ever did that.
It is a very attractive, mm-hmm. and thank you to the U.S. Space Force for that video.
We appreciate that. We'll put them in the credits.
But it's it's one of those that, like, 434 days, so more than a year.
And that, that's mission. Not even close to its record. I think it was up for 2.5-3 years on one of the flights. And keep in mind, this has done what? It's only done 4 or so flights, but each flight is a year or 2 years long.
Yeah.
And people have, you know, aim their telescopes at it to figure out what it's doing and, you know, try to intercept signals from it and what have you. I mean, we kind of have a good idea, but it's mostly a test bed. It's a test bed, platform for many of the things that, that they wanted to do with the space shuttle as well. Mm. And the advantage that that craft has, and I'm trying to think how to say this, we'll just say on the inside, it has an arm. And so it can go grab things.
If need be. it can do automated satellite maintenance. It can exchange data. It can download data. It can exchange hard drives, bays, all kinds of things with satellites that are in orbit. And in addition to that, may be able to hunt satellites. Or grab them and pull them out of orbit.
Launch the vehicles that does that. So it would go up and it would open its bay, turn it in. See, the advantage of having that type of vehicle is you can essentially get it into the close to the orbit you need it to be in, because they demonstrated that with that image that they sent back, which I was very surprised that they sent that image back, because it does kind of reveal how far out that X-37 goes. I think it's like 1700 or however many miles it was. You had to follow that up. Yeah, just follow up X-37 recent image or something. But it gives you an idea of the capabilities of that, because most people, when they think of a shuttle-like object like that there, they think of low Earth orbit. They're thinking of something that can get to the space station and back. But that X-37 can go quite a bit higher, especially depending on the boost vehicle that's launching it. It was designed to launch on the Vanguard and also on the ULA systems, but it can be configurable for other things. And keep in mind, when I was in Hawthorne, when was it? It was 2018 or 19. I had just done the tour. The video of the tour of Skunk Works and all that is on my on my YouTube page.
Yeah,
I had just done that, so it was around that time frame where I went to SpaceX. And in talking to the head of their space, I don't remember what they called it. They had some funky name for it because they always have funky names. But they were talking about a military variant of the Falcon 9. I'm pretty darn sure that it's probably seen the light of day. And keep in mind that SpaceX is launching for Space Force already.
Yeah.
It has been for quite a while. And so it's not a big learning curve for them to adapt over to a Falcon type system, because they want to be able to get the whole idea behind hypersonics and these types of systems is to get whatever ordnance or whatever device you need on, that's Palmdale, by the way, on target, as quickly as possible. Generally within 1 hour is the goal, to get something on target within 1 hour anywhere on the planet. At moment's notice, and that's the goal.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
And Elon was talking about doing that with Starship.
Yep.
Getting troops or whatever we need to get. Can you imagine being there and instead of a helicopter landing and all these guys rappelling out of a helicopter, attempts, Starship lands and all these guys come running out with weapons. That'd be a sight. That would be a sight. But that is something that is truly being talked about. As much as it sounds like we're joking about it, it's actually a serious thought.
Well, and once again, the privatization of these things is interesting to me. It's been very fascinating. I mean, of course, NASA is a civilian space agency, but even whenever you look at that document about hypersonic technology, it starts getting into NASA. It starts getting because, of course, NASA is one of the test facilities.
NASA and DARPA.
They have wind tunnels, things like that.
Exactly.
It starts. And that's like talking
the X-43. That was a NASA, essentially a NASA project. The X-43 project. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. And it's interesting to see their cooperation with such things.
Absolutely.
And especially
the last 20 years has been pretty amazing to see NASA go from what it was, which was a great organization, but unfortunately they were strapped as far as having funding to do certain things.
Yeah.
And they were always scraping by to do whatever they needed to do because some big project was taking a huge amount of money, which is why something like Artemis, which I'm thinking Artemis is going to be scaled back drastically and probably already has. And that program is way overpriced for what we're going to get out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I can see here, I noticed this earlier today, that Texas A&M, in partnership with the Army Futures Command, is constructing a kilometer-long Mach 10 wind tunnel here in Texas. And yeah, the Futures Command is embedded not only at UT or at A&M, but at UT right here in Austin as well. They do quite a bit with the drone program, stuff like that here in Austin. Yep. So...
Texas and California, Southern California, parts of Nevada, some parts, maybe a little bit in Florida, not much. But you're going to see a lot of the technology that's going to be pushed out for the next 20 years, is going to benefit those states tremendously. Hopefully not California so much. As that state's got issues, but, as far as, Nevada and things like that, I think you're going to see quite a few, new bases, or bases that are old, we're going to get, quite a bit of new touch-ups, even though, the economy is doing what it's doing right now, but I think we'll still be kicking along when it comes to the defense.
And one of the things that I was very interested to see, let me find a good spot to highlight here. Here we go.
Did it bring up Project Mayhem and,
oh, yeah, yeah. No, it brought up Project Mayhem, all that kind of stuff, which is the SR-72, basically. But this right here, where it starts getting into target areas and test support assets, and Congress may consider whether additional funds would be required to address this recommendation. DOD reportedly plans to expand hypersonic test infrastructure in coming years. And it goes into the China Lake, California complex, well as to improve air launch and underwater testing capabilities. Mm-hmm. So they're even talking about hypersonic underwater technologies. Yeah. And that's really interesting when you start considering, once again, what we've talked about numerous times with UFO, UAP technologies. The idea of USOs and fast movers underwater.
Yeah, that's where Sal Payas, the patents that he has. We need to find out what his special sauce is. That's his little magic thing. He says that all the patents are hard to read and they're kind of gibberish to your average physicist that reads them. And there's obviously a lot left out because they filed the patents under the normal patent office. There's the dark patent office where military type patents go through that we never see the light of day. Most people don't even know that that exists, but there is a patent office. And what they do is a patent, whether it's whoever it's done by, has to have an individual on that patent. So Sal Payas is the guy behind, some of this technology that we're going to see coming out. And he's over at, he's actually left the Navy facility. I think he's at a different spot now. I just saw him the other day. It's going to be interesting to see how these technologies are as far as transmedium objects are going to play out. So if we can have a single object go from underwater to air to space, and that is something that he is bringing to the table, and claims that the technology has already been tested. They didn't go as far as saying a demonstrator was built, but he definitely was adamant that that technology does work. Well, I guess we're going to be in for a big surprise.
Yeah, I was going to say the technology that you're talking about is basically like the Alcubierre white warp drive.
Underwater.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it sounds crazy. But the thing is, we already use a form of this in cavitation with torpedoes and things like that. We're basically, we are using a cavitated area in front of it to pull the torpedo faster through the water.
Basically, it's like a bubble shell around the thing, much like a warp bubble would be. But this doesn't actually, the craft doesn't actually interact with the water. It's just interacting with that atmosphere that's basically put around it. I think a few years ago, probably a year or two before Lou Elizondo reported it, was the, I had reported, I think it was in Daily Mail or wherever it was, a object that went by a Los, and I couldn't say the sub, I think I can now, but a Los Angeles class sub, at 550 knots. And I spoke to, we'll just say the, not the sonar operator. Well, I'm not going to throw him under the bus. But I did speak to a person that was, directly involved in what they heard, how they, reported that information and, who they reported it to and what have you. And, what they were trying to figure out what that was. Come to find out, you know, we kind of have an idea of what it was. But at 550 knots underwater, that's pretty quick, because the fastest torpedo that Russia has, I think, is around 200 miles an hour underwater. And that's their supercavitating torpedo. I can't remember the name of it. Pretty interesting technology above water, in the air, and in space. We're going to have an interesting time here.
And when you're basically using the same principle, but electronically or with physics or plasmas or something like that, you can start getting some pretty amazing things. And I, once again, basically this is the very simple, explanation of how the Alcubierre warp drive works. And if you want to get into that, folks, My suggestion would be go to CuriousRealm.com, go to the Knowledge Vault, and go to UFO and Paranormal. And right there is the Alcubierre White Warp Drive documents, where you can actually see the patent and see some of the circuit design and how this thing works and the principle of operation. Because once again, like you said, when you're talking hypersonic tech, it's one step behind these things, you know, and I think it's an awesome proving ground.
Yeah. The weird thing about technology is you choose the platform that you wish to push forward, and then you look at that and go, okay, what is the physical limit of this type of locomotion? What is going to prevent me from moving? Is it the air? Is it the water? Water's 25 times more dense than air, so you're going to go 25 times less the speed, most likely, and so forth and so on. And all that transgresses up into space, where you have zero things bothering you, so you can just go as fast as you want. But that being said, each object has its physical limitation of how fast you can get it. So when you, but we don't, we can't go straight from, you know, combustion engines to warp technology and not have all this other stuff in the middle. So there's all kinds of other technologies that come into play, to get us to go to those speeds. You know, the problem with traveling at the speed of light is if you wanted to go from here to wherever, say Alpha Centauri, and you were traveling at the speed of light, not faster than, just very close, 99.9999999%, the speed of light. It would take you about 4.2 years to get there and 4.2 years back. So that's kind of a doable trip. For you, you won't hardly age or really notice a lot that's going on. But a much more logical way of doing that would be to speed up. And at the halfway point, you have to turn around and slow down. Depending on it's not like Star Trek where you can just go enter the orbit of whatever planet you're going to instantaneously. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But would be nice. Well, but those days are coming. We're gonna see some neat stuff in our lifetime. I mean, I'm kinda glad I was born when I was born.
Yeah.
because it's a very unique time frame. If, you know, 500 years from now, I always think that, man, I was born too early. I love technology. I love this. It wouldn't matter what time frame I would say I'd want to still be further along. But if I had to go back in time, if I was 1,000 years in the future or 500 years in the future, what time frame would be the most awesome time frame to be in? And that's the time frame we're in right now.
Yeah,
is say from 1900 to now, that 125-year span of time is when, I mean, we went from 1903. The Wright brothers to 1969, yeah, landing on the moon. And before, yep, that, there's nothing even close. Nothing. Yeah. There's nothing. There's not a comparison that you could draw.
Yeah. Sense. Well, I mean, the easiest comparison you can draw is literally 100 years ago, like, mm-hmm, 1922, Prohibition went into effect. 1925, yeah, it was, that's repealed. Right. All right.
And there's still, like, horse-drawn carriages.
That's where we're at. That's where we're at, like, 100 years later. True. You know, so when, yeah, you start looking at it technology-wise, like, Tommy gun? Laser gun. you know, like, we have hypersonic technology now, where at that point we were being wowed by wing walkers. Yeah. You know, people just passed by planes and stuff like that. Yeah.
The technology we have now, if we went back to, say, the 20s with this technology, it would be bizarre to them, but it wouldn't be so bizarre, yeah, that they couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
Now, I think several hundred years in the future from now, it's going to be quite a bit different because that sure, curve of the technology,
well,
growth.
Well, it's an exponential bell curve. It's exactly, and that's exactly just it. The growth of technology curve is almost as steep of a bell curve as the actual rocket equation, where it's, absolutely, like, how much fuel does it take to get 1 pound of payload into space? Yeah. You know, and it's, exactly, like, it takes 8 pounds of fuel to get 1 pound up there, but now you have 8 pounds of fuel, which means you need, mm-hmm, 8 pounds for each one of those 8 pounds. and it just exponentially goes from, yeah, there, where it's like, so you want to put 1,000 pounds into space, huh? Here's how much, yeah, fuel you need. And
that's a good thing about some of the technologies we're looking at now is, you know, Elon Musk wants to go to Mars.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. It's obviously you're going to have gas stations on the way if you want to reduce that trip time, because we can get to Mars in about 2 weeks, probably about two and a half weeks.
Yeah. It's about a 30-something day trip, something like that.
The length of time that it takes us to get there is about 9 months to 18 months. And depending on the type of orbit transition that we do. Yeah. And the reason why we do that is because we take enough fuel to get us aiming that direction. We're not going to Mars. We're going to where Mars is going to be when we,
that's,
get there.
Right. That's right.
And so that's kind of how it works. It's kind of like if you're shooting something and that object's flying over, you don't, like, follow it with the weapon. You kind of, like, wait, kind of lead it that somewhere. Yeah. So the same thing happens in space. But if you could continuously accelerate, and I'll tell you something that'll blow your mind in a minute. If you could continuously accelerate your craft to the midpoint and then turn around and then decelerate, if you could take enough fuel with you to allow you to do that, it would take about 2 weeks, maximum maybe 3 weeks to get to Mars, believe it or not. So it's a pretty quick trip. It's not that bad.
Yeah.
You know, but here's one thing that's interesting. If you accelerate at 1G, which is basically your lowest way of accelerating, you don't even feel it. It's like when you're on a boat and the boat leaves the dock, like a big cruise ship, you don't feel it. If you accelerated at 1G, which is basically 32 feet per second and so forth in space, the same rate that we fall here on Earth, how fast do you think you'd be going in, say, a year?
Pretty close to the speed of light.
You'd be right at it.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be just underneath it. And,
yeah. So it really, you know, the thing is as you get closer to the speed of light, it takes more and more energy to keep that momentum going to get you to that speed, because there is that theoretical, you know, speed limit. But they've come somewhat overcome that. Remember Miguel Alcubierre had that, mm-hmm, equation in which would take all of the power in the known universe to do. And then I think the Eagle team over at NASA, yeah, was able to get that down to where it might only take the power and energy of, say, a Jupiter-sized planet to do that.
Yeah.
So it could be and it's doable.
And the methane rocket method is pretty great. I'm liking it. I have said for years, I mean, I did a whole report in like 10th grade, or I guess 11th grade, actually, about how it was for economics, so senior year, about how had we never stopped, what the financial outtake would be to get to Mars had we never mm-hmm. stopped going to the moon.
Mm.
And you know, it was like, had we never stopped, we'd have a base on the moon within 20 years, you know, like by 19, by the time we were launching the space shuttle, we would have had a base on the moon. And that's really key to regular trips to Mars, is that refueling stop, that opportunity to, cause you spend 3/4 of your fuel leaving Earth. So the idea of refueling in orbit or stopping by the moon and refueling, and then accelerating again, at that point, mm-hmm. not only do you have remaining fuel, but now you have methane on Mars. Like, we found huge pockets of methane.
The key takeaway from that, and also to bring back in some common sense to that thing, is that each time that subject's brought up, I always ask the person, I say, well, how did they get the methane there to begin with? If they bring it with them and then use that methane to go to Mars, the methane that they're bringing into space is going to be basically the same system, but the way they're doing it is not going to be exactly that. Plus, on the moon and on Mars, you can produce different types of fuel systems. One, the classic one, which is your water-based system, which is hydrogen and oxygen. If you separate hydrogen from oxygen, you get hydrogen and you get oxygen. But if you get to put the two back together again, you get an explosion. You know, that's a little bit different, but the outcome is when you do that in a rocket engine, you're basically, the only bad exhaust you're getting is steam. That's essentially it.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal.
And once again, if we can do something like that, and because leaving Mars is not hard as leaving Earth.
No.
You know, you're using much, much, much less fuel. So the idea of being able to do that is pretty fascinating. And once again, the idea of Elon Musk, like there's a lot that I like about him. You know, I mean, we've said it before, I'd like you to find another industrialist that leaves all of the patents open, you know, and it's just like, go do things with it.
The weird thing about Mars is Mars's atmosphere is 100 times less dense than ours. When you get there, the same things that we're used to seeing here, as far as how aerodynamics work and what have you, don't really work there. Keep in mind, when we put that helicopter on Mars, we weren't sure 100%
if it would work.
We weren't sure. I mean, we tested it in a vacuum and stuff like this to see, you know, how close to Mars atmosphere you would get. But there really wasn't, it wasn't unknown. That's why it was so small and diminutive, and they didn't want to put the whole project on that. But that thing, it was amazing. I think it did like 40 something flights. I was only supposed to do 3 or 7 or something.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
And, you know, that's just it. I think all in all had a fairly decent track record with Mars. Whether or not we will get there in the next 20 years, who knows? I'm excited to see what happens I've contacted Firefly Aerospace to see if I can get somebody because they're literally right down the road. Like, within like 10 miles of my house. It's pretty wild.
Just go by there.
Just walk on in. Hey.
Walk in. Hey. Hey. Take a look at the engines you got.
Hey.
I'm supposed to go to a astronaut training course in Midway, Texas. I'll send you I'll send you the information on it. The mission commander just contacted me today. It's we're training for moon landing.
Okay.
And so I go through the same astronaut training and everything. And there's some other caveat to this too, and I'll have to tell you off air what that is. It is a program. You train with astronauts and you train, in the exact same facilities and what have you.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like a weeding out process for them to go through of scaling down a group of people to go. Plus, yeah, they're going to make some money from it too. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can open that up. It's basically it's like rock and roll fantasy camp for space nerds.
Yeah. You know? It's like space camp for adults.
Just minus Robbie the robot.
But it's pretty interesting how they do it. It's a little bit, you're going to network with some technology and some industry individuals when you do that. And that's one of the things they ask you one of your goals for doing this with us is going to be that. And I'm like, I'm not sure how to answer that. If I say yes, you get to say, get out of here.
Well, and you know, that's just it. It's one of those, it is who you know and how you know them and things like that. And it would be fascinating to take one of those courses and go through that stuff. But even just reading the publicly available documents that come out, you know, if you follow these feeds.
My first interaction with something like that was in high school. I had remember when Christo McAuliffe was a school teacher chosen to go on? Okay. So during that same time frame, they also had experimental packages that were basically put out to students to see, like you had this X amount of space. It's kind of like a CubeSat kind of thing. Mm. So you had a certain amount of space you could work with, and you had to put all of your experiment inside that spot. And mine got selected. Oh, wow. Unfortunately, the Challenger accident and stuff like that, and all of those things happened in Columbia. Actually, it was Columbia that was the problem. It kind of took away that spirit. I was literally 2 weeks away from getting the paperwork to go there and do it. And I lived in Florida anyway. I was in Tallahassee, so it was like a long year. But it was neat to have your stuff selected. So that's cool.
Well, and I am always happy to see whenever programs bear fruit. I think that there's been some decent fruit born from the, from the hypersonic programs so far. Yep. I think it's really funny, though, how far along Russia and China think that we are, according to this report.
But don't tell them. They're going to watch this.
Yeah, right?
Don't say nothing.
And when you start looking at these hypersonic craft and thinking about their speeds and thinking about things like Mach 20, stuff like that.
Yeah. Keep in mind that was it 35, 37 pages or something?
Mm-hmm.
That document you're looking at is the document that they used to give to Congress to basically ask for money.
Yeah.
So that's essentially that. So it's not the variant that you see going in to the Senate Appropriations Committee and all these other different things and DARPA closed programs. You have the DARPA open, DARPA closed. Those programs where you basically go in there and you're no longer asking for money. You're basically saying, okay, we have a $55 million black budget that has already been allocated for us to do whatever the hell we want. And so at that point, you're only going into a very small select group of people to divvy up those funds. Those meetings are very interesting, a lot different than what you would see in the Congress meetings.
Yeah, and right here it says the Missile Defense Agency additionally requested $1.823 million for hypersonic defense in fiscal year 2025.
MDA budget has grown quite a bit.
And apparently that's down. So, they're trying to save us $8.3 million. That's nice of them. I guess PBS isn't getting it, but
well, here's one of the key things is that one of the strategies that the United States always seems to have is throw money at it, the biggest, baddest, this, whatever. And we always overthought things. I mean, everything just had just too much and cost too much. Artemis, like Artemis versus Starship, it's that kind of scenario. Where these other countries say, okay, well, let's look at Goliath. We don't need another Goliath to take down Goliath. We just need a rock and a rubber band. We can do that.
Yeah,
and
we just need a slingshot big enough to get our rock over there.
Yeah, bingo. And so our philosophy on thinking has somewhat shifted over the past 10 years in that we recognize that other countries can really just come in here and do what they want with this in some degrees, like with the drones flying over New Jersey, with coming in, taking out our power grid, just by shooting at a couple of transformers somewhere. And if you shoot at them in a very you know, key spot, you're going to probably achieve the desired result.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the kind of things that I think are way more important for us to look at is looking at our infrastructure and looking at, you know, is what we're doing making sense? And we don't have to spend $20 billion on one project to do one thing when we can have $21 billion projects. And at the end of all of those projects, we come up with 10 new things that are badass. Yeah. I'd rather do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And
I get the goals, like doing one huge project, like the landing the man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth before the end of the decade is out.
Yeah.
That was a bold, bold thing. And holy hell, God, I'm so glad we pulled that off.
Right.
You know, if we didn't pull that off and we sunk that much money into that. Now think about it from the other side. When Soviet Union tried to essentially keep up with us and they couldn't do it. It cost them a lot. You know, their space shuttle, I don't know if you've seen where it's at. It's in some dilapidated hangar. And these guys actually went out and actually, you know, they basically traveled over to it and were able to sneak in the building, and they spent like the night there with the Buran, which is their space shuttle. That's an amazing video to watch. If you get a chance, definitely watch that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just it. There's still quite the Cold War going on when it comes to these things, you know, when it comes to these programs, when it comes to this stuff, and when it comes to all of the different hypersonic systems that are out there, from ours to China's to Russia's, all kinds of stuff. So thanks as always for coming on, Mike, and helping us crack this stuff open, get into it a little bit more,
If we need to get deeper into that one day, we can do that. We'll have some, the X-43 being right around the time of the Tic Tac event. That's going to key into something here pretty soon, which you're already aware of. So that information is coming out. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to say it so bad.
Well, before we let you go, my friend, let everybody know where they can go to like, follow, subscribe, where they can go to keep up with the latest from 5x5 News, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. When I'm in transit, it's not so easy, but, for the most part, go to TikTok. I'm on there. I'm going to probably pump that up. I'm going to create a 5x5 live, moniker. So just look for 5x5 live. That will, start coming online here in the next month. But right now look for either my name or 5x5 News on either YouTube, Twitter, or on, TikTok. I think TikTok, I'm going to have more fun with the lives, because it gives us a little bit easier platform to play around with than some of the others. So, should be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks as always, my friend.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon. We'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff.
All right, buddy. Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. Man. While you are online, everybody, checking out all of the work from Mike Turber and 5x5 News, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can find not only all of our videos on our YouTube channel, but also playlists like all of the declassified government panels on UFO, UAP, things like that. That's also where you can find the embedded YouTube channels of all of our guests, including 5x5 News. Don't forget to stop on by the Knowledge Vault, CuriousRealm.com. That's where you can find /knowledge. That's where you can find all of our stuff that we were talking about tonight, including in the declassified programs and documents section, hypersonic weapons, report to Congress, May 2025. So, when we come back from our quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, the Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. We will be talking about Reiki energies, healing, and the connection to those with experiencers, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO, UAP activity, This easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products in your life like I am, True Hemp Science makes some amazing stuff. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch, right here in Austin, Texas, uses every part of the hemp plant from seeds to stems to roots to buds to leaves. Every part is used, combusted, reused in a spigeric process that creates a full spectrum product complete with terpene profiles and all the goods that you need for your body. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. We have had him on so many times talking about aliens, ancient aliens, aliens in the Bible, experiencers in faith, so many things. And, you know, with everything going on in the world right now, Reverend, I am akin to believe that everybody needs a little bit of energy work right now. There is so much going on in the world that, you know,
we could all use
like a nice Reiki session. We could all use something to just kind of bring our vibration up. And that's what I wanted to have you on to talk about, because you've been doing Reiki work and energy work, counseling, things like that for years. And it's a huge part of your life that I'm not sure if many people are actually aware of.
You know, Chris, I think you're right, because I'm known for, you know, ancient aliens and you know, UFO stuff. And so, it's been a great part of my life. It changed my life. The two topics are intertwined, because I started doing this right around the time as I was getting my experience, as having some of my experiences. And then I had an experience where they kind of, these beings kind of encouraged me. And so I just took the ball and started running with it. I've worked as a hospital chaplain. So I incorporated into my ministry. And yes, the energy work is crucial, for all the obvious reasons, but especially now with everything going on socially, politically, what's going on in the UFO committee, community, people are really on edge. Yeah. And so what I try to do is incorporate the healing, if you will, with my counseling practice. And it's a good 1-2 punch. And just to make people, it may not change the entire situation that they're going through, but a relaxed body is a healthy body. And so by bringing the anxiety down, we can probably respond to life situations as opposed to reacting to them. And so I kind of stress that. I also want people to know that, the healing is a large rubric, and it means different things to different people. Many people think it's okay, I lay my hand on you and you take up your bed and walk. Sometimes that happens, but I also have had people, in hospital situations die. more peacefully after these energy sessions and prayer. And some of them, the difference is some people can be healed and still go on to life after life. And some people can be cured and come right back to the hospital or to wherever, you know, within a week or so. So sometimes there is that difference between healing and being, quote unquote, cured. It's interesting to me because in the Judeo-Christian pantheon, under that rubric, much of Jesus's ministry was healing.
Yes.
Was hands-on healing and prayer, or you say the word, distant healing. And it's interesting that a lot of our churches kind of look at that as a relic, that kind of situation of a time gone by. And it's interesting now, and I get it. You know, there's a lot of quackery and fakes out there, but it was such a big part of his ministry. And you would think that some of these churches would be a little more open to it, a little maybe having healing services. I remember when I first started in my ministry, I belonged to a spiritualist church, and we had a segment in our church service where people would come up. There were me and maybe two other ministers. Maybe they were Reiki practitioners. Some were, and some just had that gift. They could just lay their hands on you. And that was part of the service, an integral part of the service.
Yeah.
Yes, there was the message, the sermon. But I find that rare these days.
I also find that rare. Now, granted, you know, the Catholic Church has numerous services throughout the year, a Festival of St. Blaise, things like that. Like, hey, if you're a sore throat sufferer, feel free to go get your blessing on your throat the day of St. Blaise.
Yes.
Today, the day that we're recording this, is Feast Day of Mary, you know, things like
that. Oh, yeah, so May 1st. Yes.
There are numerous things like that where, yes, there are laying on of hands that happen.
Yeah.
Throughout the year, but it's nothing that once again is focused on in that kind of way. And I've actually seen a few times here in the last few years, especially on Feast Day of St. Francis, having laying on of hands for animals and pets.
Yes.
Which I have found beautiful. I'm actually getting a little choked up thinking about that. But just the idea of, and that is a beautiful place to start this, you know, because there is the scripture, and it's one that I refer to regularly when it comes to energy and energy surrounding us and that exchange of energy that happens freely. That yes, we can control, but also just kind of happens freely. And that is the scripture of the woman who touches Jesus' cloak.
Yes. Yes.
And he's like, who touched me? Like, I felt you take my energy.
Yes. Yes. It's an amazing story. And that's exactly the thing. He's around a throng of people, but you know, he's like a rock star, people brushing up against him, but he specifically felt her touch the hem of his garment.
Yes.
And said, who touched me? Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. Makes you kind of think of what kind of person he really was, that he could feel that. I mean, I think it would be rare if we were at Madison Square Garden and someone just came up and touched the hem of the garment, and he perceived that the power had gone out from him.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful story. But I'm looking, it says that in this book, it's a wonderful book. It's by Morton Kelsey. You may have heard of him. Mm. It's called Healing and Christianity. And he gives a whole history from pagan time, Greek time, up until the time of Jesus and beyond. He says that 41 distinct instances of physical and mental healing are recorded in the four Gospels. There are 72 accounts in all, including duplications. And it just goes to show what a large part of his ministry was blessing and healing. And like I said, it's a shame that we seem to have lost that. Now, in the UFO community, you know, there's this thing called Reiki, and which is an energy healing modality, laying on of hands, and you don't have to touch the individual. There's another book I want to recommend. There's several. This is a guy whom I met. His name, he's passed away. I think he died in 2009. His name is Zev. Oh, hold on, hold on. Zev Coleman. And he was an Israeli. He lived in New York City. It's called The Secret of Healing. The Healing Powers of Zev Coleman. His story was that, you know, he had to serve in the Israeli military. Everybody has to serve. This was, I don't know whether it was back in the 90s or 80s. But anyway, and so they had bivouacked and they had their mission. And so he decided to go up on a mountain. He left a note saying, "I'll be back. I'm up on the mountain." So he goes up there and he sits down and he sees this silver craft flying back and forth over him. And then he sees these beings. All of a sudden, he's surrounded by these beings who are kind of translucent. And he's in a cloud. He calls it cotton candy. And he says they had no faces. They all had his face on it. And now this is, he's not asleep. This is real time. The next thing he knows, he wakes up, he's on his back, and he hears the noise. They're banging and telling him, "Come on, it's time to start your next shift." So he had missing time. He was up there maybe a day and a night. He comes back off the mountain. He's playing with his military meds. You know, they're playful. He touches one of them to tickle them. And the guy says, "You're electrocuting me. You're electrocuting me. You're electrocuting me." And he's like, "What?" And then he touches another friend and the guy falls down on the ground like he's almost unconscious. And so Zev is like, "Oh my God." And he goes over to the guy. He says, "Are you okay?" And the guy says, "I feel fantastic." And he touches another guy. And so this is what happened. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, I went three times to his healing. He was pricey, at least it was for me. You know, he took a credit card, that kind of thing. He had a studio or healing. He rented a room in New York on West 58th Street.
Okay.
And it was amazing because you lie down on a table. You weren't there more than 20, 30 minutes, and he would wave his hands over you, but you would feel like electricity was going through your body.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I hadn't had that feeling since my experiences. And then you would just get up and get off the table. And you had this feeling of well-being. Now, I was also doing a lot of energy work then. And I also was having my experiences. But I did get a chance to go to Mr. Zev Coleman. And he was good at what he did. I just found out that he passed away in 2009. He called his modality bioenergetics, but he was very open that these were extraterrestrials who helped him do this.
That is incredible, because there is a lot of work in that going on right now. I know the work of Kathleen Martin centers a lot around healing energies. The change of faith of experiencers after their experience and their connection with something divine and some kind of, once again, healing energy. It's pretty fascinating to see that, and to see that is something that is attached to that. And even once again, the idea that he went onto a mountain
Yeah.
And found this because I'm going to pop something up on screen. Just Mount Kurama is the mountain in Japan where Reiki was actively founded. So it is not uncommon, in ancient culture, in history, in religion, and in these practices as well, for this energy to come from mountains. I actually, courtesy of a good friend of mine who goes to Japan regularly, have a rock from Mount Kurama.
Oh, my goodness.
But lovely, yeah, I have rocks lovely. From all kinds of places like that. Whenever I have friends, they're like, oh, can I bring you something? I'm like, bring me a rock. Bring me a rock.
I love
it. If you're going somewhere cool, bring me a rock. That's what I'm about. And it's one of those, it's very fascinating that there is this connection to mountains and energy and to mountains changing people's energy and to people coming back from the mountain in a very different way from Moses. The transfiguration on the mountain with Jesus to everything.
Yes. And it's the symbolism is just so rich. You know, with these stories about the power of these kind of sacred places, maybe they're vortexes of energy.
Yeah.
The chapter that he tells about his experience is Encounter on the Mountain. And it just changed his entire life. There's another wonderful book. It's a little older. It's called Born to Heal by Ruth Montgomery.
Okay.
Born to Heal. And it's about a guy, he's passed on. His name was William E. Gray. She doesn't use his name, because at the time she wrote it, he was alive. But he was another guy who was a very, 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 I know her, a very gifted healer. Wow, this is new, huh? She's a German woman, and she had a high clientele because she charged $10,000 to become a Reiki master. But she made her living teaching Reiki. And so, wow, that's beautiful. She's still out there at it. Yes, the amazing true story of Mr. A and the estate. This is a keeper. His real name was William Gray, Gray.
Okay.
It's a keeper. It's just inspiring. And none of these people are particularly religious. They believe in, they have a universal spirituality.
Sure.
But they're not in any type of dogmatic or doctrinal religious faith. Zev was born Jewish. And this guy, William Gray, which just talked about universal energy.
Okay.
So those are great books. I'm trying to see. There's a wonderful book by Walter Weston called How Prayer Heals. He has several books. Walter Weston, How Prayer Heals. He has a book called Healing Others, Healing Yourself. It's all hands-on healing, yes. And there's another wonderful book by a woman named Tilda Norberg. It's called Stretch Out Your Hand, Exploring Healing Prayer. And she does pastoral care with an emphasis on healing. Of course, a shameless plug, but my book on the metaphysics of spiritual healing and the power of affirmative prayer. And so, Larry Dossey has written a book of several books. He was a Vietnam vet who was a physician, and he talks about the power of prayer.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because when I was in New York living there, and I was on the chaplaincy team at hospitals, it's interesting. We were the chaplains who believed in this. We were kind of made to feel that we were in the way. You know, that, yeah, that's the religion and okay, but we're the real physicians here. And they were.
Sure, sure.
But when I, but, you know, very rarely would they believe in prayer, the doctors, or even consider it. But when I moved to the South, it was like a horse of a different color.
Oh, yeah.
These doctors had no problem in saying a prayer, or let's call the chaplain to have a prayer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was refreshing, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting just getting into that concept of the seeing the whole patient. You
yes.
know, so much medicine is symptomology and
yes.
treating symptomology, not
yes.
necessarily deep diving into what might be causing the issue.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And the whole concept of a whole person is a person whole spiritually, you know, that was part of the remote viewing class that I was taking, all of a couple weeks ago from Vantage Point Remote Viewing about, doing a health reading is that, somebody may have, like, hip problems, lower back problems, things like that, because literally they have things that they are dragging behind them. Like
yes,
it is a physical manifestation of what's going on in your head.
Yes, yes. It's beautiful. Louise Hayes talked about that, right? And it was true. Most people that I had talked to and they had a back problem or a leg problem, the metaphysical diagnoses, and you know, we don't diagnose, but you know, I would say, who's supporting you? Where do you get your support? Well, I don't want to be a bother to anybody.
Yeah.
So I don't really talk to anybody about my problems. Thus, no support. Thus, you're back. Or people who had stomach issues, you know, and people had real things. I'm not trying to say, but, you know, what is it about life that you're not stomaching? What is it that you don't want to swallow? Yeah. What is it that you're not accepting into your life?
Yeah.
And usually that would happen with people with stomach issues.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And it's
so you're right.
It really is the fact of, and we've talked about this numerous times with you on the show, the idea of frequency and not just frequency of sound. Of your voice and what you are manifesting and putting out into the world every time you say something negative or do something negative.
Yes.
But the idea of frequency of thought as well. So
powerful.
You may be thinking horrible, horrible things about yourself, you know, things like that. And it's one of those, like, you really do have to kind of psychologically and spiritually get your house in order. And that's typically any time, I dated a girl for a while that was a massage therapist and, you know, that it's one of those, it's very much the same thing, you know, no different than spiritual counseling or what.
No, you're right.
We are prone to repeat the same injuries all the time.
Yes. And, you know, like you watch your diet, you know. The diet is also, what do I let into my consciousness? You know, I remember Marianne Williamson, when she was teaching Course in Miracles, she would say, you know, you get up in the morning, you know, the first thing you do is you read the news or you listen to the news and you get worked up and then you have a cup of coffee. So now you're pouring caffeine on your anxiety, which is making you more anxious.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of your diet is, what am I letting in now? Maybe I need to take a break from the media. Maybe I need to take a break from this. Well, maybe I need to get up and read a nice inspirational poem or something from a sacred book or something. But that's part of your diet too. What you're taking in.
Yeah.
On a spiritual and emotional and psychic level, as well as, you know, whatever is edible.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And I mean, quite literally, here's a study, an article from the Mayo Clinic on how news rewires your brain. Oh, my this goodness. Is something that we talk about on the show regularly. There was a study done, right, oddly enough, right at the end of COVID, talking about the effects of negative news cycles on the hippocampus of your brain.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And the hippocampus yeah. regulates a lot of decision making. It regulates a lot of anger. It is a gateway to the amygdala, you know, which is your fight or flight response.
Yes, that reptilian part of yeah. the brain.
So the idea is that the more you watch negative news cycles, the more bruised your hippocampus gets.
And so changes your frequency.
When you're locked away for 2 years and just pounded with this on social media, pounded with it on television, broadcast, yeah. everything, everywhere.
Yeah. yeah.
You wonder how we all came out a little fecocted from the pandemic, you know? I mean, this is an actual biological response of our body to the stressors around us. Like this is a prime example of what we're talking about.
It's science.
And if you choose to not consent into that loop of constant anger, and into the loop of, you know, looking at the negativity, staying with the negativity, staying on a negative plane with everything, you'd be surprised how fast some of your health issues may just clear up and move along. Maybe not to the point of like, oh, I'm healed. But you'd be surprised.
Oh, no, I agree. And I think that because when you don't, you lower your vibration yeah. and you're more susceptible.
That's right.
To more. What's the word? Just lower entities,
yeah.
lower energetic beings and, you know, lower energetic people as well.
Sure.
So it's very, 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 you know, healing is such a layered, you know, one of my favorite movies is a movie I'm sure you've heard of. It's called The Robe.
Yes.
Okay. And an old movie, 50s, when they started yep. doing Technicolor. And I don't know, you remember the scene when Richard Burton is talking to this woman. She couldn't move her legs. And she was a follower of the teachings of Jesus. And she played the harp. Right.
Yep.
And Richard Burton, of course, is he still, you know, trying to find the disciples and what have you. And she's telling him about her encounters with Jesus. And I'm not trying to force Jesus on anybody. We're just talking about this.
Yeah.
And he says, basically, well, if he was such a magician, how come he didn't cure you? And she says, oh, but he did. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
He healed her emotionally because she was full of anger. She was full of malice and hatred and yeah. poor me. And he left her like that, but he healed her emotions so other people could see that this doesn't have to take away your joy. That's healing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She didn't get up and walk. She was still crippled.
Yeah.
But her inner life was transformed.
Absolutely. And whether you're talking deliverance from illness, deliverance from bad chakra alignment or deliverance even from an evil spirit through exorcism.
Exorcism, yeah.
Reverend, it's the fact of it begins with that counseling. It begins
yes.
with gathering the data, finding out what, no different than a doctor, how did we get to this situation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell me the story of how we got here, because the story of how we got here may explain everything before we ever put you in scanning unit one.
Well, and you know? What you're doing with the remote viewing, maybe you pick up something, you got to figure out a way, you know, you ask permission, yeah. you got to figure out a way. Now we have to dialogue.
That's right.
You know, so yeah. now the healing is not just the psychic healing, the hands-on healing. Now it's the communication.
Well,
which can be just as healing.
And that's just it. And that this is where I would kind of like to pivot a little bit into that. Because mm-hmm. a while ago, you brought up the idea of response versus react. especially when it comes to your energy, things like that. And that is, I think it's one of those that once you've gotten a lot of your spiritual things in order, it's one of those things that you do tend to respond much more than react. And there is, there is that hippocampal amygdalal part that we're talking about right there, where it's like your hippocampus wants you to respond. It wants you to be measured, everything else, but you bruise that, you short circuit that, you're going to go straight to reaction, which may not be the best thing for you.
Exactly. And so, you know, just being aware, you know, you know, you were in seminary. They, you know, when they taught us about pastoral care, you have to be a non-anxious presence.
Yeah.
Remember though, remember that you got to, when everybody's up here, you got to bring it down here.
Yeah.
So there's the vocal part of that. There's the communication part of how do we heal. Course in Miracles talks a lot about that type of thing. So, you know, it's almost like a spiritual psychotherapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and I love it. It's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, cause we all have our gifts, as Paul reminds us. And we all have a part to play. And also realizing that sometimes it's not right away. Sometimes the person may have to visit you a couple of times. Sometimes you may be that person. You have to go through something a couple of times. Because a lot of us get really frustrated, healers as well as healees, that it didn't happen spontaneously.
Yeah.
Or I may have to do a little footwork to get it. And we get discouraged, but this is all part of that healing journey. I think it's fantastic. And, when I retire, even though I'm doing it now as well, I'm going to devote most of my days, not unless the universe has something else planned. This is my office, and just using the healing prayer with the Reiki and the counseling.
Mm.
And that will be the shift in my ministry from working in a parish to more pastoral visits, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, especially in response to that response versus react, there's a phrase that I will never forget from my spiritual director, and just from philosophy, and that's the Delphic maxim, know thyself.
Ah, yes.
You know?
Yes.
It explains everything forever and always. If you know why you react in a certain way, because it's one of those, the world is not responsible for your triggers, folks.
That's right.
The world marches merrily along. It is unobliged to your triggers, doesn't care about your triggers. It's going to happen with or without your triggers. The only person responsible for your triggers is you. You know, and as soon as you kind of take the reins of consent with that, and I use the word consent a lot on my show when it comes to these things, when it comes to anything spiritual, even the consent of being angry at somebody. Mm-hmm. You want the ultimate letting them win? You feel free to be angry. All right? You want to make sure that they win?
Yes.
You be angry about it. You be good and angry about it.
What is the old saying?
That'll make sure they win.
anger is one letter away from danger.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
But I say amen to what you're saying, because you know, that's the word, responsibility.
That's right.
Okay, I need to be accountable, but I need to be responsible for how I respond. Because if I'm over the top,
that's right.
Sometimes you never get a second chance to make a first impression.
Well, and it's also that able to respond, knowing that you're able to respond instead of react if you so choose.
Yes.
You can respond. You don't have to react. You don't have to lash out. You don't have seem angry. You have the ability to respond. Yeah.
What was Plato's thing, or was it Socrates? Anybody can get angry, but to be angry with the right person.
Yeah.
At the right time.
That's right.
In the right way.
Yeah.
In the right. Yeah. I love that. That's not easy to do.
Well, and, you know, even whenever you boil it down, and I think if I'm not mistaken, that same lesson comes from, the lesson of how to treat people and just the idea of, you know, if they aren't in the room, if they like those things, if they aren't able to defend themselves, it sounds like you're trying to gossip right now instead of trying to help somebody.
Yeah.
You know, because if you were trying to help them, they would be here. But notice they aren't here. Right.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. You know? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's yeah. And I want to say this before time is up. You know, and this is, I'm switching gears a little bit about the metaphysical part of this, is that you can say that prayer, you can send that thought at a distance. Do you know what I mean? Of course, we know about the centurion who said, Jesus, my servant needs to be healed. And he says, okay, let's go. And he said, wait, no. I got a lot of stuff going on. You know, I can give orders and all that. And he says, if you say the word, I know it will be. I know he'll be healed. And so I just say that to remind people that there's no such thing as time when you're saying your prayers and this distance. And of course, when you're sending your Reiki energy or whatever it is. And so it's the person is even they could be in Japan. But as far as you're concerned, they're right there in the room with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a fantastic thing to think about. You know, the idea that, and once again, something that we talk about regularly, that quantum aspect to the universe, that concept that even right now, you and I are sharing an electron shell by everything in known physics. You know, we are 90% empty space held together by a quantum field that's pretty fascinating. So.
It is. It just makes you have to rethink everything that we were told about what reality is and how reality works. But I got to tell you, it's this healing journey has been one of, you know, of adventure. Of a challenge, but I love it. And I thank the universe for it. And my visitations also contributed to this a lot. So, you know, and I feel like that this is what it's all about, to heal and the many facets and layers of what that means to whoever's listening.
Yeah.
Because there are many ways to do it. The touch, the kind word, the tenderness.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't mean people will, their cancer zips away and, you know, a miracle has happened, but, anything that just eases the pain and suffering, the anxiety of our brothers and sisters, that's the catalyst for healing.
Well, and especially with that in mind, at what point did your healing journey in Reiki begin? Was it before you were an experiencer or after you were an experiencer?
It was after. Reverend? It was after. Well, it started, I was getting Reiki before my experiences.
As a recipient.
Yeah, because the asthma was really, really intense. It always was. I had it since I was 6 months old, but I wasn't helping it any because I was still partying and drinking and drugging and all that. And a woman by the name of Catherine Linnell, who was a Reiki practitioner, she's since crossed over. A friend of mine recommended me to her. She lived right around the corner from me and she was reasonable. And she said, Michael, this is something you may want to try. And it was a little scary for me in the sense of when I was doing level one, level two, then the master level. It was like the more Reiki I did, the more visitations I got.
Interesting.
Yeah. And when they came, I would be paralyzed, but they would, it was electricity running through my body, They worked on my throat chakra a lot as well, because I still get people who say, boy, your voice is so soothing. Or there's something about your voice that's very distinctive. Pardon me, but I remember some, I'd be laying in my bed and I'd feel like,
wow.
But I was in Boston. Early 90s, and I was at an anti-racism training for trainers. It was train the trainers.
Sure.
And I was staying at a bed, someone's bed, a bed and breakfast type thing. Had my own room. And that night, I was paralyzed. I couldn't force my eyes open. Like an icon. Okay. This is way before icons, but it was an icon of a gray. My eyes are closed, pointing like it's, he's at my right eye in my mind's eye, pointing to my left eye. Like, don't look at me. Look at what I'm pointing to you. There were hands in a prayer position with a red lightning bolt through it. As if to say, that's what you should be doing. That's what, as a matter of fact, my business card, I took that icon and put it on my business card. But it was a gray, like you would see an icon on your emoji, yeah. Like an emoji, pointing, big head, don't look at me, look over, and it's so pointing this way, and there was a pair of hands in prayer with a red lightning bolt. And I took that as healing, energetic prayer is what you are to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, that's what happened. And the thing that got me was a woman who came to me a couple times for healing. She had a cane. After three sessions, she had no cane. And I would say maybe a week, within that month, she called me. And she says, I'm not going to curse on. She says, you're a freaking liar. You're a freaking liar. And I was shocked because I said, hey, you're walking. What is going on? Yeah. And she said to me, she said, and then she laughed because at first she said, let me tell you something, young man. I was doing healing before you were born, which wasn't exactly true, but probably when I was small. She said, that's not Reiki that you're doing. You can tell these fools out here, but you don't fool me. She says, that's that energy from your space friends. That's what that's from. That's not Reiki. And so I just said, well, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do? And then she just laughed because every time they came and, you know, they vibrate on such a high frequency. Of course, it interacts with your own energy field. Sure. I mean, you know, when after they came, there were times when, man, I could go like almost a week, 10 days with little to no sleep. I was so wound up. Wow. And then I'm doing the Reiki on top of it. But luckily, my body after like 10 days, I mean, I was just pushing it. I would be standing over someone and I could feel myself rocking because I just pushed myself. I didn't feel like sleep, but my body was starting to say, you're a fool and we're tired.
Mm.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, because once again, you had experiences before this happened. So,
and after, yes.
By this point, I guess you had come to term with your experiences.
Yes, I did.
I was no longer afraid of your experiences. Because I can imagine, especially if they started, if the frequency of things picked up, manipulation of you, your energetic field started picking up.
No, I was afraid. there was a part of me, the mysterium tremendum, the part of you that you crave for is the very thing that scares you.
Yeah, yeah.
I was afraid because I still, the bizarreness of it. You know, they would always come when I was alone, except the first time. And I could be home alone and, you know, it's post-traumatic stress. I still have it now. I could get up to go, or if you think I'm going to get up and boom, there's a being there and the bizarreness of the way they look, that kind of thing. So I was afraid, but I wasn't as afraid, but just how they could just pop up like that. And then there was a period where for like a couple years, I didn't see them. And it was almost like, did I do something wrong? Did you give up on me? Where are you? But even today, my wife has been away for a week. She'll be back tomorrow for work. I'm more open about this now. I've been on podcasts and mentioned it, obviously. But I close when she's not here. I know it's not going to keep them from coming. I close my blinds. I close my shades.
Yep.
I leave my light on until I'm this far from sleep. And then I turn it off and...
Yeah.
And that's still the post-traumatic stress of that.
I can appreciate that because since the day of my encounter and encounters with shadow people, I cannot sleep with the closet door open.
No.
It can't happen.
No.
And it won't happen as long as I'm around. It won't happen.
Yeah, I just can't do it. Now, she'll be back Saturday and it's a little easier. We also have a dog. Now, granted, if they wanted to visit any of us, the dog would be put asleep.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever.
Now,
but I, you know, I still have post-traumatic stress. I probably always will to a degree.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, exactly. And that brings me to my next realm of questions here in the last 15 minutes, which is when dealing with somebody, when doing energetic work on an experiencer, is it ever the fact that their PTSD is revisited? Because it did, you know, it's not uncommon during a massage session, even as you're releasing those energies, as you're releasing where those things are held up in your body, that memories come flooding back.
Yeah.
Things like happen.
No, you're exactly right.
Is it the case with Reiki as well?
Well, that's when I will try to put them on the table.
Sure.
But not, or either try to do it the next time. It's going to, when you see the Ancient Aliens episode, you know, I thought I was, and I'm not trying to shift gear. I just thought I was kind of over it. But when talking to them, I almost broke down and cried because it's still in the body. The body remembers everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it will, but that's when I just try to lower the voice.
Okay.
To be, you know, just not judging and let them have their feelings.
Okay.
I don't say, oh, come on, let's get you. Let them have the, there's a Kleenex here if you need it.
Yeah.
Because now they feel safe enough to discharge, to get that out, to get those feelings out. And then we can go from there. But yeah, you're revisiting it. The breath starts to get shallow.
Yeah.
The eyes get a little bigger. They start darting around, you know, it's like any type of post-traumatic stress, I guess.
Sure.
But the Reiki, either that during that session or setting it up for another session, helps to get your chakras balanced, get your blocks, get yourself unblocked, and can just calm that a little bit so you can stay in your body. It's not the fight or flight.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And even coming to recognize that and coming to recognize what it is, you know, once again, that react versus respond, once you have the respondability, once you've learned what your reaction is and what the source of your reaction is. So even getting more familiar with that in a means like Reiki. Where you are in a safe space, you are with somebody who's there to help you energetically. You are with somebody who can help redirect that energy.
You got the music on.
Yeah.
Even at the church. And this is not even an experiencer. There's a guy I just found out in my church. He's in his 80s. He has Parkinson's. He's on medication. It's helping, but he gets the tremors. He's open. And so he says, I hear you do this healing. I said, I try to. I can't promise. So he's going to come.
Beautiful.
And I got a chair. I don't have a, I don't bring my massage table there. And I turned the lights down. I light some incense.
Yeah.
I put that music on and I work on him or her or whoever's That's coming. Great. And you can see them relaxing into
release.
You can see it.
Yeah.
And the anxiety, because when you're anxious, you know, the post-traumatic stress is like someone pushes a button and now it's stuck. And now I'm hypervigilant.
Well, and
I can't stop it.
And that's just it. The unfortunate thing is, yes, it is ingrained in us. It's ingrained as a response in our brain for a reason, because for millions of years, it has worked fantastically to keep us alive and to help us survive. But unfortunately, most of the world around us triggers these preternatural things.
Yes.
When we do not need them to be triggered whatsoever.
Exactly.
Whatsoever. You know, so retraining your brain to reuse that energy, to recognize the energy, but use it in a different way, recognize that something is happening, and once again, realize the ability to respond instead of panic and react.
Exactly.
And with that, I've got another question here that you may have been asked before, but you may not. Have you ever had your entities pop through to somebody else during a session? While working on them energetically, things like that, have your entities ever visited somebody else?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Twice recently.
Wow.
But one is more concrete, one a little more abstract.
Okay.
I had someone here not too long ago, and they get Reiki pretty often from me. And I was touching them, and they told me that they felt that someone had lifted them up. They didn't see this person, and they felt like there was an extra pair of hands on them.
Oh, wow.
That's number one. Number two is, I had someone here on the table, and afterwards, and these people had never been visited before, and they drew a picture, and they said, I felt like I was dozing off. I was asleep, but they said, but I was still in this room, and they drew a picture of a Nordic. They drew a picture of a reptilian and a little gray person. And they said they were standing there at the door. Now, you know, is this a dream? I was told that if everything is the same way, if it's in real time, they drew the plant over here. So they just said they were standing by the door. Nothing distorted, nothing like that. Mm. And I can show you the picture if you want.
Sure. Yeah, if you've got it. Because it's one of those... I was just curious about the fact of whether or not you actively channel this or are just connected to it. And
hold on.
Go ahead. I'm just filling space.
Drew. Now I know you can't see. I'm going to do that. You see that plant? Well, that's my table.
Yeah. Yeah.
But where if I move the table, there's a plant. Okay. Hold on. So it should be there.
Oh, wow.
That's what she saw. There's my door right there. There's the bookshelf.
There's the plant.
There's the plant. And that's what she said was at the door. And she said they were looking at us. This was on February 19th, 2025.
Wow.
And she said they were looking at us and doing this. Yeah.
Talking about the situation.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, And this woman had never seen them before.
Well, and as you were getting that picture, I was filling space and kind of just wondering, like, if you have ever wondered or considered, do you consider yourself a purposeful channel for this, or do you consider it the fact of it just flows through me? Since your experience,
I think it's both.
Okay,
because even though the little people, even though he did like that, I have the feeling that I could have said, I don't want to do that, and it would have been okay.
Sure.
And so, and the other thing I try to, when I talk to people about these experiences, is that, and you know this because you're on the path, it wasn't all of a sudden they came. And all of a sudden I was on, you know, they expedited, I believe, but I was already working on meditation. I was already reading existential philosophy. I was already doing the tarot readings and the I was already doing the work. So when they came along, it kind of expedited all of this stuff. But, and I say that because you got to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
there was a wonderful meme on Facebook the other day. It's saying, don't remember, you got to do the footwork. Don't just look at the memes.
That's right. Yeah.
You got to do the work. Yeah.
No, and that's just it. It really does come down. And whether you're talking manifestation, whether you're talking answer to prayer, things like that, it all comes down to, are you doing the work and are you open to interpretation?
Yes.
Those are the two key factors. Number one, and the example I used to give with the junior high and high, I need to get a metal slinky for my desk. I don't have a slinky, but the slinky was the example. I would give every kid in my class a slinky the first night. And then the thing was, we'll get to the slinky. Just behold the slinky. Think about the possibilities of the slinky and the slinkiness of it and the way it could slink. The ways it could slink, the many things it could do, the potentiality bound up in that spring.
Yes.
Now, the problem is, you don't push that spring, that potential is just sitting there.
Yeah.
It's literally waiting for you to push it.
There you go.
So that's the universe. That's your relationship with God and the world around you, period.
Yes. It's all choice.
It's you. It's you. It's your push that gets it going. And that push may be positive or negative. And the resulting, equal opposite reaction coming back to you from the universe will be positive or negative, depending on what you pushed.
That's right. And how, you know? and your intentionality.
Yeah, precisely. So the idea that we have this potential, it's bound up within us. We just have to push it. You know,
amen.
Even when it comes to Reiki, healing, that kind of stuff, it's the fact of, you have to make no different than the 12 steps. You have to admit that you have a problem here, that are doing is untenable and will no longer work.
and that's where religion has been a culprit in a lot of ways, because we've taught people, you're not worthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't have any of this power.
Literally, these the programming put into them.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so people don't rise to low expectations. You don't hear ministers talking about the pericope where Jesus says, greater things than I do, you will do. You don't hear that.
Yeah.
You don't also hear, I have not just come to bring peace, I've come to bring a sword. You don't hear that either. That's another thing for another time. But those affirmations that he's saying, you know, that I have the same thing you have, but I just don't have anything else. What I am is potential in you. Well, the church for 2,000 years has said, you're not worthy. You don't deserve it. You're a miserable sinner. You're a wretch. You're this, that, and the other. How does anybody make it?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Without passing through their narrow gate to make it.
Yes. Yes.
Quite literally.
Yes. I you and I are here to erase all that. and to rebuild. You don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
No.
But you do want to say, wait a minute, this message got, as the young folks says, let's not get it twisted.
That's right. That's right.
Because it's been twisted. Let's not get it twisted. And it's been twisted for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
And we got to untwist it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
And that's what you and I are doing, well, and the other light workers out there.
And you know,
don't get it twisted.
No, it's interesting because we just did a whole episode on the papal prophecies and end times and just times put together. And I thought about you the whole time because literally the message throughout all of that was hope. Hope. Don't forget, these apocalypse, it doesn't matter how fun or cool the apocalypse and the apocalyptic doctrine is. It's hope at the end. It's not supposed to be hellfire and damnation. It's not supposed to be living your life in constant fear because of this. It's supposed to give you hope that you triumph so that you can just live your life. So that, like,
amen. Not, amen.
Not amen. To live an oppressive life or oppress that's others right. during yeah. life or anything yes, like I, that.
So you can have more life, more what? More abundantly.
That's right. That's right.
That's what we want. That you can have an abundant life.
Yeah.
Have a resplendent life.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but we got to read. It's supposed to be good news.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's supposed to be the good news.
Well, and it's supposed to be good energy too. And that's just it. Just to bring this full circle here toward the end of the conversation is the idea of, we swap energy with people all the time.
All the time.
You know, we are constantly sending out energy. We are constantly receiving energy. So we have to learn to filter that. We have to learn to filter the words that we say. The example I used to give was rewire your mouth through your brain and then your heart. Think about it first and feel it. Like if somebody said the exact words you're about to say to you, how would you feel?
Yeah.
And then maybe rethink your words.
Yes.
Very you know, Buddhist. Before they Very come Buddhist. Out of your mouth.
Yes.
Because you have the opportunity. We all have the opportunity to change that vibration, to make that vibration happen.
Yes. I agree.
I love the fact that as you are nearing retirement from daily church work, that you are entering this service for yourself. Quite literally, I tell people all the time, if good mental health and you learning to say no is what helps you, good. Like, go be selfish. You know, go do the things that make you have, like I told you today, I released an album this morning.
Yeah.
Just cause I like doing it, you know, and thank God I have a beautiful, loving, understanding wife who knows that it brings me joy and that I need there to do is. Things that bring me joy.
There it is. Yes, you got to keep them in there. You got to keep because they know what's up. And you know, I got some years to go before I retire, but I'm thinking ahead.
Yeah. No, and that's just it. That's just it. It's one of those putting your talents to work, putting your cosmos given talents to work and the talents from your space brothers who, you know, once again, may seem extraordinarily frightening. And I choose to see it much more as, the gift of wonder and awe, fear of the Lord, you know, in that proper sense of, you are so awe-stricken.
Yeah.
That you're afraid. Not necessarily that you are like afraid of them.
You said it. That's what I'm talking about. Thank you for articulating that. No, I'm not afraid like, oh my God, let me go crawl.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's just that, whoa, you know, it makes your heart stop because it's not like you see the blue light coming.
Yeah.
It's like you just turn and they're there and it's a, holy moly.
Yeah.
But yeah, that kind of fear, not like, oh my God, I'm going to down the street and call the police.
Now as we wrap things up, what would your final message to experiencers be? What would your final message to people who are considering exploring the world of Reiki healing for themselves or for a family member who may be suffering from these things, Reverend?
I would say do not be afraid of it. It's the gift that keeps on giving, and our ancestors have been doing this from time immemorial. It is a healing modality that all religions talk about, that quantum is talking about now. They're just catching up with what our ancestors knew. And especially with Reiki, you will have this for the rest of your life once you get attuned to it. But even just go get on the table, let somebody service you that way. You owe yourself that. You know, you're worth that. And, I would remind us that we've got some difficult days ahead.
Yes.
In a lot of ways, but, in the words of Dr. Howard Thurman, who was Dr. King's mentor, you got to remember the contradictions of life are never final. Never final contradictions. It can be rough, but Good Friday has to come before Easter.
That's right.
That's just the way the world works.
Yeah.
And just be not afraid. Be not afraid.
Yeah.
You can do this. We can do this. We can do this.
Absolutely. Reverend, thank you so much for your time as always. Before we let
thank
you go,
brother.
Where can people go to find your books? Where can people go to schedule a Reiki session with you? Where can they go to get in touch with you?
Okay. You, first of all, you guys need to go to this man and get a website done. And if you got one, get another one done or add to it. My website is michaeljscarter.com. Okay. Chris did my website
literally
about 6 weeks ago. So I'm telling you that. Yes, it's a commercial. You can go to buy my books on Amazon.com, Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. Get Chris to do you. Wait till you see what he did for my website. I have an Ancient Alien episode coming up. I just don't know when. It was supposed to come out in March. I will keep you posted. And it's about my experiences. There'll be some other experiences on as well.
Yeah.
So I'm wishing all of you a gentle peace and many blessings.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time as always, Reverend. It's always beautiful talking with you. I am lifted as always after our conversation. Hold the line
real quick
while we close things out.
Okay.
While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Reverend Michael J.S. Carter at michaeljscarter.com and visiting his store where you can find all of his books, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com/store where you can find not only the work of Michael J.S. Carter, but also tons of books, classes, videos from our guests, as well as tons of binaural beat music there for therapy use. We have a new album that just came out from Curious Research called Remote Viewer. If you're a remote viewer out there, this album is made for you. It is an hour long. It is made specifically with binaural beats that will help get you to the point of remote viewing session and take you through that. So, of course, also make sure to stop on by Curious Research. That is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log right there on Amazon, everybody. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFOs, cryptids, this is your pocket data log to write down all your data in the field as it happens so that you have the best data to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. Without conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.